This is the User Experience Hamburg Radio. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks so much, Armin, and again, Florian, for, you know, having me here. It's just a great sort of pleasure in a lot of ways. It's kind of like a battery for the brain coming to Lufana, even if, you know, the social life depletes the energy of the body. Something I struggle with as time goes on in Lufana and successive evenings of media theory drinking. So, I've taken the invitation to participate in a workshop very literally. So I came to Lufana in total anxiety, in a state of mild panic, after, you know, successive kind of things the last 4 weeks across Europe, without anything and little idea of what I might even do beyond a title and a few lines. And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, this is the nightmare. So, very kindly, I was holed up in the hotel and wrote something. So there's something wonderfully unpolished about what I've got to do with you today. And it's about not research that's been done at all so much, but I'm sketching out a follow-up project that continues on from the one that we still have 2 years of funding to see through with. So this will be a project, broadly speaking, on the geography of data centres. And I just want to sort of sketch some contours for that this morning and see how we go. Also, this is software for the slides I've never used before. I think there should be a few images. I hope so, because I'm not any good at pressing the buttons. Something I forget. So I changed the title. Oh, it does work. Good. I changed the title slightly, right? I'm not going to say a hell of a lot about predictive cities, but I did want to think about the preconditions for predictive cities through the idea of the data centres, right? But we can hopefully see how that might be a bit more clearer as the talk goes on. The digital is now everything and everywhere. While the missing flight of MH370 is yet to be found, for the rest of us, there is nowhere left to hide. The horror of cybernetic extension into the vicissitudes of daily life is now well and truly a reality. CCTV cameras, motion capture technologies, RFID chips, smartphones, locational media, GPS devices, biometric monitoring of people and ecological systems. These are just some of the more familiar technologies that generate data and modulate movement and consumption within the logistical city. You know, which might relate perhaps in some ways, though, after the talk this morning, I perhaps would rethink this in some ways to, you know, Kittler's reading on the city as medium. I hadn't noted or read that before this workshop, and I thought maybe there's something in there to help me think through this idea of a logistical city, which marks a departure from both the global city of finance capital and the industrial city of factories. The logistical city is elastic, its borders are flexible and determined by the ever-changing coordinates of supply chain capitalism. Populated by warehouses, ports, intermodal terminals, container yards and data centres, the logistical city is spatially defined by zones, corridors and concessions, which of course have a colonial history as technologies, apparatuses of control as well. The logistical city is a city that subtracts the time of dreams to maintain the demands of 24/7 capitalism, as Jonathan Crary so kind of terrifyingly sketches out for us in his really wonderful book in other ways. For many, the model has become the world. Our tastes are calibrated and relayed back to us on the aggregation of personal history coupled with the distribution of desire across sampled populations. Decision is all too frequently an unwitting acceptance of control. The biopolitical production of labour and life has just about reached its zenith in terms of extracting value, efficiency and submission from the economy of algorithmic action. Nowhere is this more clear than in the sentient city, where the topography of spatial scales and borders gives way to the topology of ubiquitous computing and predictive analytics in which the digital is integrated with the motion of experience. In the sentient city, data becomes a living entity, measuring the pulse of urban settings and determining the mobilization of response to an increasingly vast range of urban conditions, traffic movements, air quality, chemical composition of soils, social flashpoints. The horror of urban life is just beginning. Florian Kramer phrased this nicely in a recent posting to NetTime mailing list, and I have a large quote which I'll read to you now from him. He writes, "This is likely the beginning of a social class and status symbol reversal for electronic technology and digital devices. It's foreseeable that affordable healthcare, transport, insurance policies, pension plans will only be available to those who subscribe to behavioural tracking and control via mobile sensor devices and have themselves monitored for compliant lifestyles." He goes on to write, "And whatever will be left of welfare checks and unemployment severance pay will only be paid on the condition of behavioural tracking as well. Freedom of electronic devices will be a privilege of the wealthy. In the near future, to be upper class will no longer mean that you carry the latest electronic gadget, but you can afford the luxury surcharge for a life without tracking devices." The dystopia of the present leaves little room for responses other than despair and depression. All too often, resistance to the distribution of power and the penetration of financial capitalism is, as Max Haven argues, not only futile, but quite often reinforcing that which it claims to oppose. Resistance is not interventionist so much as affirmative. Haven then writes, and I quote, "Finance, as we know now have it, is as a system that reads the world by calculating the risk of resistance to liquidity and allocating resources accordingly, already incorporates resistance into its systemic imagination." He writes, so, you know, for me, this kind of signals quite a moment of despair, if you like. "In this slaughterous world, the nihilistic option is to find joy in the pleasure of immediacy, consumption, and aesthetic gestures of critical self-affirmation. No matter the foibles of human life, predictive analytics and algorithmic modeling deploy the currency of data to measure against variables such as productivity, risk, compliance, and contingency. What then for labour and life outside the extractive machine of algorithmic capitalism? Can sociality reside in the space and time of relative invisibility afforded to the vulnerable status of post-populations? Can living labour assert itself beyond the calculations of enterprise planning software and the subjugation of life to debt by instruments of finance capital? These are disturbing, complicated questions that require collective analysis if we are to design a life without determination. The global logistics industries and supply chain capitalism provide the backdrop for the empirical and conceptual contours of a new collective research project with Brett Nielsen, together with researchers based in Australia and overseas. The project is at its very early inception phase, and what I mean by that is this is the first time anything's been written on it. So following some discussions the last couple of weeks with Brett and others in Athens, so it's the moment of pulling, you know, working out what even the recipe book might be. So if it's funded, it will build on our current logistical worlds project, which you see some images for here from the site, which tracks China-led globalization through infrastructure in Piraeus, Valparaiso and Calcutta, and the earlier Transit Labour Project, which investigated how circuits of labour were tied to the operation of global logistics industries in Shanghai, Calcutta and Sydney. The proposed project will broadly address the politics of infrastructure as it intersects with the experience and condition of logistical labour and life within urban settings. Logistical labour emerges at the interface between infrastructure, software protocols and design. Labour time is real time. Logistical labour is more than a unit to be measured according to KPIs. It is the lifeblood of economy and design, exploitation and consumption. Logistical labour underpins the traffic of infrastructure and circuits of capital. With an interest in the geography of data centres located in 3 to 4 sites across the world, the challenge of method for collective research on what is customarily regarded as the hidden substrate of infrastructure will continue as a problematic to be addressed in experimental ways. In setting out these notes, I've already taken it as a given that the politics of infrastructure invites a critique of the quantified self, where self-tracking bodies, as Florian Kramer notes, then are regulated as data-managed socialities as they move within the logistical city. In the society of compliance, Normative measures and standards are set by the corporate state seeking to expropriate value from labour through regimes of fear, insecurity and self-obsession. Yet there's an element to the profile of what I would term post-populations that is in some respects external to logistical media of coordination, capture and control. I'm thinking here of the peasants dispossessed of land in Calcutta who commit willful acts of sabotage on infrastructure in the new IT towns, or for that matter, the Roma population on the outskirts of Piraeus Port in Athens, who, customarily raid the railway, the intermodal terminal line between the port and an intermodal terminus in order to retrieve metals that can be sold on scrap metal markets. And then we have the proletariat and unemployed around the world who are not governed or managed in the name of political economy, but unleashed as a necessary surplus to capital, which requires relative stability for infrastructures of investment to withstand assault that arises from social chaos. Yet post-populations, who to some extent can be understood as ensembles of non-governable subjects, can all too often be vital sources of technical invention that is then absorbed into systems of production. The obvious example here would be Shanzhai culture in China, with this wild modification of mobile phone features, like particularly dual SIM card slots. Like, why aren't they in every phone, right? Because I don't know how many you have, but I've got about 20 of them. And, you're just sort of interchanging these SIM cards constantly. You need something like a machine gun system, right, that allows you to flip through them if you're not into the high charge of roaming costs. This is why, they are set free. That's to say, this idea of post-populations. Since the parameters of capital accumulation can only be replenished when elements of contingency are programmed into the operational requirements of the logistical city. There's another dark side to logistics, whose just-in-time economies are driven by ever-increasing demands for efficiency and productivity. The waste generated by economies of consumption result in secondary economies of waste disposal and recycling. Frequently informal and often circumventing sovereign control, the logistics of waste provides the basis for a media theory of logistical disposal, and in different ways opens a route into a geomedia theory of particle aesthetics, as we heard yesterday from Yossi. But this is a separate topic and one that I just raise here, and I'm not going to address it in any way, not just because of the constraints of time, but because it's not something I know very much about. I'm now going to move on to a line around infrastructures of circulation. While Brian Larkin defines infrastructures as the physical forms that comprise the architecture for circulation, Keller Easterling is keen to emphasize that the dispositional activity of infrastructure is not reliant on movement, but rather on unfolding relationships inherent in its arrangement. For Easterling, designing infrastructure is designing action. There's an interesting determinant quality to Easterling's proposition here, even if she prefers to bridge her thought with Latour's thesis on the performative action of humans and non-humans as indeterminate or dislocated. As Easterling notes earlier in her short text in Mark Shepherd's collection on the sentient city, many infrastructures are the urban formula, she writes, the very parameters of global urbanism. And, I think Orit yesterday gave us this fascinating genealogy of this yesterday in talking about, the kind of formatting of cities. And, we also similarly heard this morning from Christoph. It is in this aspect of parameters, and more precisely the politics of parameters, that has captured my imagination recently in writing about a theory of logistical media. Logistical media determine our situation. GPS, RFID and voice picking technologies, coupled with the software enterprise planning systems and supply chain management, are all media of communication, coordination and control. These features are well known by business management and organization studies, computer science and accounting, but they're yet to be the object of research for critical media theory. When infrastructure is defined in relation to systems of communication and the logistics of global supply chains, it's hard not to retain a sense of movement in conjunction with Easterling's unfolding arrangements of infrastructure. As John Durham Peters reminds us, like Harold Innes before him, the notion of communication as transfer of physical entities such as ideas, thoughts or meanings is something we might hold on to. Now, how might the parameters of IT infrastructures shape the production of knowledge and the constitution of subjectivity? Can a relation even be established between the content of data and the economic interests that frame decisions on investment in IT infrastructure, in addition to the technical requirements that distinguish different types of data storage and the production of its hardware? Like much of the infrastructure that supports our daily life and global economies, the topic of data centers is one that is largely surrounded in mystery. The very banality of communication rarely compels our imagination to take the step into making the concrete abstraction of infrastructure something we might know and address. The German business software developer SAP claimed to touch, 63% of the world's transaction revenue. That's something, we came upon in the workshop we did here last year on SAP. One more recent report placed SAP as holding 25% of the worldwide market share in enterprise planning software, revenue rather. And SAP's closest competitor, is Oracle, who only hold 13% of the market at the time of this report in 2013. So it's therefore not a stretch to say that the power of SAP rivals that of the Murdoch Empire. Yet media theory remains largely unaware of the existence of enterprise planning, enterprise resource planning systems. Software studies is all too often bewitched by the utopia of the open source movement, and the digital humanities is struggling to lift itself out of the archives, even if there's this scramble for method going on more recently. A theory of logistical media is a theory of software, infrastructure, and global supply chains, crossed with the labor of bodies and brains. Logistical media are shifting to cloud computing services, which in many countries are a national policy priority in an effort to increase productivity, innovation, and trade. At stake for governments and commercial entities alike is the extent to which labour embedded in global value chains will tie economic and social prosperity into competitive digital economies. One indication of such a perspective was recently reported on in the IT and business pages of All Africa, which noted the push of German software developer SAP to drive innovation at universities and research centres in Kenya. And I've got a quote here which I'll read out from that report. "Professors and students are on the forefront of innovation, so to accelerate research and co-innovation on SAP HANA, we are opening the platform to academia," said Bernd Vels, the Executive Vice President and Global Head of Solution and Knowledge Packaging at SAP. He goes on to say that faculty and students are working in diverse fields such as computer science, artificial intelligence, healthcare, national security, environmental sciences, and smart cities will be able to advance their research and demonstrate new and innovative approaches to create a world where the Internet of Things is harnessed in real time to improve people's lives. So, the Internet of Things integrates ubiquitous computing, as we know, within urban settings, producing a city of calculation and measure. Forever generating data from the movement of people and things, the computational power of embedded technologies is geared toward the economy of efficiency. Data analytics emanating from the Internet of Things needs to be tested within the laboratory of media theory, interrogating the precepts that claim to know objects liberated from epistemology. Now, this second section is a brief sketch of the geography of data centres. In probing the question of infrastructures and their geographies, we might ask where the data centres are located for these business imaginaries of cloud-based economies. Indeed, what sort of data traffics through different data centres distributed in strategic locations throughout the world? Are there juridical regimes specific to different types of data? How is the provenance of data complicated in legal ways by the location of its storage? What sort of protocols of hardware and storage are required for, say, financial data as distinct from the data collected by the state or military apparatus, or produced from the logistical life streams that define our social media worlds? And, how might we revive a critique of the state based on its support of commercial data centres through financial levers such as attractive corporate tax breaks, generous land leases, flexible labour regulations, and free trade zones, among other forms of state subsidy funded by national citizenries? Certainly, there's been a crucial labour cost related to questions of infrastructure and geography. As we can note in the protracted struggle by German labour union Verdi in its recent demands for better working conditions in Amazon's warehouses. Infrastructure, it turns out, can itself be highly mobile and flexible, as reported recently by Reuters. I quote them here, and this is news I think we know. Unfortunately, my respiratory system is under serious pressure over the last 2 months, so I might just need to sort of try and ease it back a little bit. Amazon is planning to build 3 new logistics centres in Poland and 2 in the Czech Republic, prompting speculation that it could seek to shift work across the border from strike-hit centres in Germany. Consider also the emergence of what is referred to in one higher education business report as the financially sustainable university, which is seeking to overcome the fragmentation of data-driven processes due to the conflicts and complexities of internal operations, and advises instead the use of outsourcing data centres. Again, I'll refer to this report, I'll quote it here. Our third-party data centres, whether they are managed or cloud-based, could provide some more sophisticated solutions, higher levels of security, greater flexibility and capacity, and lower cost than internal solutions. All, the report says, quite joyfully, with greater accountability and less politics. In striving after ever more enhanced techniques of optimization and efficiency, the logistical university becomes indistinct from any number of organizations whose core goal is to extract maximal value from data-driven processes. Politics is certainly a nuisance, but usually only in terms of distracting management from decorating their portfolio careers rather than leading to any substantive loss of profit. Again, the Amazon warehousing plans for Eastern Europe are a salutary reminder of how a certain structural continuum between precarious labour and corporate operations exists. Both are predisposed to flexibility, you know, albeit with important variations. The regime of flexible accumulation special to post-Fortis capital, you know, characterised by outsourcing, you know, offshoring, just-in-time production and inventory flows, these sort of things, function to undermine the conditions of labour whose experience of flexibility is normative rather than exceptional in a world of increasing economic uncertainty and existential insecurity. So this is to say that, you know, let's drop any kind of reference back to the golden age of Fordism. It was a glitch. Having said this, politics is not entirely irrelevant to the strategic decisions around the geography of investment related to data centres. As one consultant on IT infrastructure in the Asia-Pacific advises, most countries in Asia are lucrative markets, this person writes, to set up and grow businesses, barring a few which are political and technological environments as deterrent factors. But politics here usually consists of more force when it's wielded by the sovereign power of the state rather than labour unions. Google's exit from Beijing in 2010 was frequently reported as an act of Western corporate defiance and social justice against China's insistence on censoring search engine results. But it was nonetheless a submission to sovereign control and a humiliating retreat from the centre of contemporary capitalism. And of course, there's also a business reality to Google's decision to quit China. Following the withdrawal of the more innovative local search engine, Baidu, only increased its market share, going from 47% in mid-2006 to 64% today. And already that figure's dated, so it could be around like 80% market share. You know, so this was kind of the reality that, you know, the business reality that Google had to address. We know that the sort of lovely rhetorical gestures to kind of human rights issues is on, you know, total bullshit, right? I mean, please. But it had surprising traction, of course, in the business news that, you know, hey, Google, thanks. You know, the state can't beat China, but you can exit it. You know, we love you. Over the past few years, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore have become strategic sites for investment in storage facilities for cloud computing. Companies like Google have built data centers in Taiwan and Singapore to accommodate the rapid growth of internet users across the Asian region. As reported recently in PC World, While the Taiwan data centre is on 15 hectares of land in central Taiwan, the Singapore data centre in Jurong West is built on a smaller area closer to 2.5 hectares. I mean, these sizes are not so interesting, but what I find interesting is this next part. It is designed as Google's first urban multi-story data centre and is in the neighbourhood of a local primary school and publicly run housing. You know, so I mean, clearly I think there's this relation, correspondence between property value and the location of these data centres. I mean, there's always these deals going on, these forms, right, of state subsidisation manifest in a number of ways to attract investment. If the level of political economy, we just have to revisit perhaps the example of MIT Media Lab and its spectacular failure around the world. India, of course, was smart enough to tell them to basically fuck off. Ireland, endured MIT Media Lab for a surprisingly long amount of time. We know that profits were always siphoned out of Ireland, and upon MIT's exit from Ireland, I can't remember, was it before the mortgage crisis or after? I think it was before, wasn't it? It was before, I remember.
4 or 6.
Yeah, so kind of the sort of across the UK at the time, the sort of smell of mortgage crisis was on my horizon. It seemed pretty clear. Some of the banks were starting to fail. But you know, MIT exited early, and after that, soon after, of course, we saw the Irish Celtic economy kind of collapse as well. Local authorities, nonetheless, right, are keen to attract such businesses, which they expect will produce a range of spin-off benefits for local firms. As Google Taiwan Managing Director Chen Li Feng remarked in 2012, following the announcement of the US $300 million Google facility in September 2011, with the US $700 million slated for long-term investment in the region, he noted, "We anticipate this data center will evolve into a cloud computing technology hub and will create a supply chain here in Taiwan." By the time of its completion in December 2013, the budget for the Taiwan investment had risen to US $600 million. It had doubled, in other words. The Taipei Times goes on to report that Google's local suppliers included Quanta Computer, which supplies servers to Google, and Nanya Technology Corporation, which supplies memory chips used in servers. Data centers, then, are key components of the global logistics industries and reshape the economy of cities in terms of the composition of labor and the integration of manufacturing and service industries and the formulation of trade and communication policies designed to attract investment. The three Google centers in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Singapore produce a geography of the cloud that includes the 6 data centers in the United States, along with 2 in Europe. One might suppose that the high temperatures in Taiwan's hot summers, along with the potential instability of weather associated with its typhoon season, might act as a deterrent for infrastructural investment in the country. But it turns out such climatic variations provide a basis for Google to tout its green credentials and innovative design in its use of nighttime cooling and thermal energy storage systems that cools large amounts of water at the night, quantities of water at night. But the issue of electricity consumption required for running data centres is not insignificant. My colleague at University of Western Sydney, Tanya Notley, recently noted in a draft she's developing that server farms currently use more than 1.5% of the world's total energy, electricity, and this is rising, with more than half of this energy used in the cooling process. Related to the geography of data centres are the imperial and colonial histories of communications infrastructure. The submarine telegraph cables that first established the corridors of trade connecting the territory of empire to the speed of communication. And here, certainly I'd be interested in hearing more of this work that I think Florian has done in, your history of cables and telegraphy. I expect ties into this in pretty clear ways. And as we might all know by now, following the publication of Michael Lewis's Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt, the relation between the geography of fiber optic cable and algorithmic capitalism is determinant in the economy of high-frequency trading. The co-location of exchange servers with the computers of high-frequency trading firms function to minimize the journey of data, resulting in a form of insider trading that always outpaced the efforts of brokers, hedge fund managers, and ordinary traders. There are currently 3,227 co-location data centers in 99 countries around the world. The United States commands 1,265 of these. The UK has 210, and Germany is host to 167. Australia has 88, India 97, while Hong Kong, Indonesia, and Taiwan hold 40, 32, and 4 respectively. China has 54, Russia 38, Ireland 18, with Luxembourg hosting 12. The Czech Republic's got 17, Malaysia 28, South Africa 19, Pakistan has 10, and Turkey 31. Co-location data centers would seem primarily geared toward finance capital. Though there is an obvious reason why finance capital should hold a monopoly of interest in the co-location data centers, given the types of services offered at many of these centers, which include dedicated servers, virtual servers, cages, rack cabinets, managed hosting, and so forth, according to the, you know, spiel that you find on these various data center sites promoting their services. You know, but I think, you know, we can begin to think, as I move into the concluding section on counter-imaginaries of data, you know, we might sort of wonder then what other sectors might co-location be a valuable investment for. Indeed, who are the chief investors in co-location services? Can we envisage our own artistic practices or critical research as having some use for co-location services? Given the immediate difficulty, if not considerable mystery, in obtaining information related to questions of commercial investment, I'll finish with some concluding remarks on the role of counter-imaginaries in the geography of data. The production of counter-imaginaries are not inconsequential for the politics of infrastructure. You know, as Christoph detailed, I think, for us this morning with these examples from radical architecture, at least I was happy to start reading those examples in this way. Indeed, they're a key component in the invention of concepts that frequently enough migrate as memes from the margins of critical theory and the net cultural moment discussed yesterday by Clemens of sovereign media to the policy discourses of the state and market strategies of the firm. The obvious task for designing counter-imaginaries here is to engage in the multiplication of communication formats. Template cultures have become today's iron cage of reason. They are the unknown default whose genealogy is not without power in placing limits on expression in seemingly invisible ways. Speculation is no longer the work of imagination, but rather is consigned to the operation of machines and the default settings of parameters. The problem with the post-digital settings of today is that we're unable to think within the box. We can speak of a politics of parameters, but ultimately this is still knowledge specific to engineers who design the architectures within which we conjure our imagination. We can no longer harness our imagination, only click on predetermined options. You know, so what, therefore, might it mean to design a program of research and cultural practice that exploits the geography of data infrastructures as we know it? And that's where I end. So, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ned. We have plenty of time for questions or comments, observations. Marie?
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. I had just like one kind of like small technical question. It's kind of ridiculous. But how did you get all the data on the server centers? Because a lot of them, at least, we were working on a different group in New York, like a lot of them are like hidden or like not necessarily publicly announced, especially when they're building them around these rings around, you know, for high frequency trading.
And yeah.
So I was just kind of curious, just in a pragmatic role. And then one thing I was really, really curious about, you kept saying I'm kind of post-population.
Right.
And never elaborated on the world. I just
yeah. Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks. You know, of course, the first question is, you know, the problem we have in our current project on logistical worlds, you know, which is interested in how might we diagnose the governing power of algorithms present within enterprise resource planning systems devised by SAP, Oracle, you know, and any number of other firms. And so you can talk to computer engineers and scientists and get some distance. You can speak with people involved in implementation and securitization, which I was fortunate to do a little bit here in Germany last year, and get some other sense. But ultimately, I guess, you know, the problem of infrastructure is very much this problem of the black box, right? And so how might we proceed with critical research around such entities that have such governing power in economy and labour, life, and so on and so forth, the production of space and time. So our method, at least within, say, the work we've just been doing in Piraeus at the Port of Athens, has been to say, well, you know, the problem there is that China has a 35-year lease on two of the terminals. It's pretty much impossible to enter the port. And what do you do when you see it anyway? You see a spectacle, right? At a distance, you see an interesting way in which patterns form from these different enterprise planning systems. Navis 5 is operating in the Greek side of the terminal. Navis Sparks 5, the US software platform. A KTOS, South Korean devised system for terminal operating systems, is present within the Costco site. And at the aesthetic level, right, at just a basic aesthetic level, it's kind of fascinating just to see the way in which containers are stacked quite differently across port spaces, right? And then there's this other aspect that comes into play with these systems, and that is that despite the interoperability, the way in which the port is managed across the two competing entities in the case of Piraeus is through paper, the media of paper. So, you know, in other words, containers are shifting from what is a transshipment port of the Chinese-operated terminals to an intermodal kind of territorial transport system, largely for the Greek side. And so you need to track the movement of containers. You could do this, obviously, through the software. It has that capacity. Instead, it's done manually and written on paper. So, I mean, this sort of prompts for me, you know, the moment in which to think governance through media technology and media forms. So, you know, when we can't understand this black box of infrastructure, of data centres or whatnot, what we've been able to do is just externalise the research then and say, what are the kind of economies parallel and operating precisely because of the presence of these infrastructures that we might know something about that we wouldn't otherwise if we didn't have the invisible object of infrastructure to start with. So that's the sort of one sort of response to the problem of method there. The post-populations gesture, because I can tell you it's certainly not a refined concept that I've developed at all, but it comes out of the work I was doing a few years ago in China along with electronic waste workers, and my students, where I began to sort of think of these people as non-sovereign subjects, as non-governable subjects, because of legal reasons. The electronic waste industry is illegal since 1991-2 in China, yet, you know, the disposal centres require a licence to operate. Very few of them do because it's prohibited as a pricing. This impacts upon the kind of market price of copper that's distinguished between those with the licence and those without. My idea, you know, obviously is a gesture to this Foucault population territory governance, right? So population is something that can be measured, that can be calculated. It's quantifiable. The sense of city, we might say, is a city of locating population within territory. I'm interested in what happens for those who escape measure. And this was the idea of surplus that I had in the example of Shanzhai culture. You know, there's no formal, if you like, measure of that economy, yet it migrates into the production system of tertiary economies, precisely because it provides a form of research and development that isn't a labour unit cost. And I'm sort of keen to, I guess, establish a parallel between the migration of that form of innovation, the formalization of it within high-tech industries and economies, and then what we're capable of as artists, as cultural researchers, as media theorists, as concept designers, whatever you want to call yourself, in also then in the last part of the talk, infecting the apparatus with concepts and seeing how they're formalized and seeing how that might operate as a form of intervention in the plan.
Can I ask you just like a quick follow-up? But just a follow-up on that post-population question. So, there's another point you said that, and this has come up a lot in people's talks about combination of evidence or the way that the resistance is really built in. So one of my questions here is also then, how are you thinking if it's not about measure, though, is it still outside of calculability in the sense of financial techniques around uncertainty, not around risk, which is kind of the kind of endpoint, but kind of indefinite. You kind of work in the fact that you have some unmeasurable variable that you're actually speculating on. So I'm just curious, like, if you're thinking of looking at
Yeah. Well, look, I don't know so much about high-frequency trading, that's for sure. But my basic understanding is that something like the dark pools, you know, are predicated on the measure, the speed of measure, which then determines the instance of transaction beyond, you know, the devices, tools of your regular traders and brokers. And the rapid retreat we're seeing from a number of banks, you know, because of the supposed illegality that might be surrounding such a form of algorithmic devised insider trading. So, I mean, the distinction you wanted to make was between measure, risk, and contingency?
Well, not necessarily in finance. I'm kind of thinking more about, like, supply chain and
Uh-huh.
design. And also, at least the discourses, and again, I think what's interesting since you have this material, you can ask material to, like, your strata operating, but in terms of the kind of fantasy of these logistical worlds, in terms of, you know, Simmons or SSAP or whatever, is sort of systems that can grow or can change, and that are engineered around a kind of at least discourse of uncertainty,
yeah,
and not finality, and that therefore there's almost kind of a way. So then I was interested, like, is this a surplus?
Yeah.
So it becomes the kind of ground surplus, which I guess is what you're saying.
Right.
I'm wondering if you've been kind of looking at the connection, whether there's an engineering or in these ports or stuff, people are like actually kind of
taking
into account if you want to design.
Right. So the system is, you know, consciously designed to accommodate this, right? I don't know. I'd need to talk more with programmers, I guess. My sense looking at the operation of supply chains is that contingency is assumed as necessary for the movement of people, finance, and things. We do have, when you talk with people from SAP, this assumption that, you want to be rushing to the investment of tens to hundreds of millions in this terrible architecture of SAP, because in doing so, you're able to operate across the network of suppliers, operators, within the mesh world of SAP. It sort of defines who you trade with. And I guess if I could know something more about software design, I would be able to say something more about one of the interests I had then was in rethinking the concept of the political through protocolological conflict as it's found within the distinction between informal economies and their use of, you know, pre-installed social media software to manage their own supply chains and those of the high-end, high-tech, high-manufacturing economies, which are much more formalized, complicated in their architectures and so on and so forth. So I was interested in saying, let's rethink the political through protocolological conflict. You know, whenever we rethink the political through the state, like, let's fall asleep. Roll over Chantal Mouffe, no more of you.
think you're in trouble now because Paul's tweeting that now.
Thank you.
We got more questions or comments? Hi.
Maybe
don't.
Counting data centers. I was wondering about what do you think about programming techniques like MapReduce for you? That means scalable algorithms, how to program stuff using million CPUs. It's a very normal technique in today.
Okay.
So we don't care about data centers anymore. We care about bandwidth. We care about distribution of labor between data centers.
Right.
And we talk about X as a service. Platform as a service, storage as a service, programs as a service, whatever. Whenever they're complicated, this is a kind of load balancing debate. So I have to say, where is some, and we know that every morning at 9 o'clock, there's a peak at Google, because all the occupiers surf on their computer,
okay.
The first page is the front page of Google. So they have a load balancing about the world to say where the resources located, the bandwidth, and so on is part. So it's not really the topic of data centers anymore.
Yes.
It's the political stability of the city, or the area they are located, if you need water, if you need energy for it, and so on is part, for the practical reasons. And the real stuff is about so it's a local machine areas, it's kind of distributing. Computing and so on and so forth. And this is a kind of, this is behind cloud computing.
Okay.
So I have no idea about what the thoughts about this kind of virtualization. There's not no location anymore. You can find the rooms and services like SAP or social software or any other kind of service you want.
Yeah, look, I think you know a hell of a lot more about this than I do. I don't know any of this. But I do like this idea of, you know, saying, well, what happens with the virtualization, I guess, of knowledge and data, right? Is it without location? And I guess, you know, in such a preliminary way, this is what this paper is, entirely preliminary. You know, of course, location, I'm suggesting, is pretty crucial. And one of the interests we have in the current project is to think of the multiplication of governance, you know, through infrastructure, the operation of infrastructure, software, economy, and so on and so forth, through technologies of concession, of zoning, you know, of corridors. The 10T corridor is certainly something to have your eye on in Europe at the moment. It's the architecture defining the future, right, of communication, transport, and energy movements. And sort of in so doing, kind of establishing the borders of Europe through infrastructure. That's the kind of interesting geopolitics of the 10T corridor plan. The other interesting point, I'm not addressing your question at all, is the kind of portion of money assigned to the 10T corridor plan of these three components, right? The IT, the communications portion is something like 14%, right? Like minuscule. So, which is interesting, right? Like, does that suggest that the communications architecture is already in place at the level of, you know, hard infrastructure, fiber optic cable, or no way? Where's the fiber optic cable across most of Europe, right? It's copper, I'm sure, right? Copper wire. It's not, right? I mean, Australia flirted with this idea of putting fiber optic cable around the nation, and they've got a government voted out of the parliament. You know, the costs are substantial, and then Europe is just a real problem in terms of realizing such an ambition. So, yeah, I'm just, I guess, re-emphasizing that where the selection of these data centers that we might study would be is totally undefined because we don't know. But I ran through that list of numbers, not just because numbers are kind of numbers, but because it gave to me a surprising indication of how politically unstable countries have significant number of data centers within them. Pakistan, notably, Turkey would be another one. And you know, what are the conditions that attract investment in these places for data centers? what sort of legal suspensions, you know, perhaps are going on? Indeed, what sort of data is trafficking through them? And why the sort of market decisions, presumably on the part of firms investing here, to make those decisions? It's a way then of then, as I suggested, tried to at the end, to rethink the operation of the state as well through, you know, the politics of infrastructure. These are, I can only say, are gestures that I'm making.
And one thing that strikes me that's interesting about this is the kind of the political economy of infrastructure, you know, data centers and kind of these communication networks, cables and so on, is that part of, I guess, what your point is that the geopolitics have become interesting. If you look at where they're situated, and, you know, the only people who really need to have cables and data centers that can kind of respond microseconds is where you have the financial centers, right? So it's a very obvious determining factor. In a sense, all that other stuff doesn't matter so much, right? If you, because the cloud computing stuff, it doesn't matter whether it takes, you know, 10 microseconds or, you know, whatever. I have no idea what the measures there are. They're pretty minute, right? But there's a very specific bit of economy. So part of, if you could take that argument very far, is that what you have is kind of the smart city being kind of, I don't know if it's a smokescreen, but it's certainly not, if we look at political economy, then the interesting stuff happens around financial centers and what they can do, and there's certainly kind of a logic of having to make data available on the economy elsewhere, and the economy is such of economics, trade, and so on, working with data elsewhere, but where it's really crucial is in these data centers. So it's a kind of, so I'm wondering whether then we should be looking at data centers, not, you know, the kind of, in a sense, the smart city is not necessarily a smokescreen, but the question then becomes, how is the smart city connected to the financial city? And how and how far is there a logic that extends maybe in terms of making all that stuff available for kind of financial speculation, for example?
Yeah.
But there's also this other side of this copper economy, because copper is available and people steal copper. So as you showed these pictures from Athens,
yeah,
where they produce their own cables and their own switches in a way. So there's also this other economy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I love about the aesthetics of media history is that we have this this universe of ruins, right? Universe of redundancy,
okay.
A universe of, it has a time and then it no longer has a purpose. And so what are the ruins of infrastructure as we know it through data centers? You know, Adam Hyde, and this is where artists, I'm really kind of once again excited by the idea of artists. You know, Adam Hyde, I remember working with him a number of years ago, and he was involved, some of you would know this project, in rebooting the radio control towers from the ex-Eastern Bloc states once they'd been decommissioned, you know, following 89 and everything else that followed. And so you had these sort of satellite systems plugged up by the military with aerodite and nails. And you know, the artist's intervention was to get a signal from the satellite again and use the radio tower and start transmitting through the ruins of, you know, what were once the present. So, you know, I mean, you know, one of the strategic kind of artist projects might be to devise a cultural production through data centers is setting out a plan for the future use of these, what will inevitably be ruins. I just think how, you know, given the black box, what, you know, you can say what is to be done, what can be done. This is where the depression can so easily just take over, I think. You know, the nihilist moment of, well, let's just let it happen. But I like instead, you know, these imaginaries then. I think there's a political capacity there.
Sorry, do you have a follow-up question?
There's some view on financial, but this is a bad interpreting. The other one is about the industry. This is SAP is strong as well.
Yeah.
This is all in Germany, I think industry fought it all over. This is bringing IT into industry. All the processes, doing the customized products, what kind of with this kind of agile planning, agile production, and so on and so forth. And this is a large stuff we have to do for car manufacturing, for one kind of industrial manufacturing.
Yeah, right.
And this is based on cloud computing, this is based on connection between BMW and Bosch and whatever. So we're doing the final assembly, and doing the parts, and so on and so forth. So this is a kind of what we don't need is this high speed network for that, but we need some intelligent coupling of services for that. This is a big area beside the Japanese bagging area of financial.
Right.
It's interesting to see the kind of cloud scopes to help destroy the normal supply chain together.
No, right. I mean, you know, for example, instead of celebrating the artisan and rebirth through maker culture, you know, what might mean instead to acknowledge the fact that it emerges precisely because of these global supply chains operating. So my interest is how to exploit the dominant architecture rather than, you know nothing about it, or, you know, celebrate the kind of little gestures around the place otherwise. So, yeah, no, what might it mean for cultural production to use SAP? That may be something terrifying, but...
You have a question?
About counter techniques. I wonder if you have heard about the Space Monkey. It's a project, it's a product actually, a hard drive that can be connected. You just attach it to your local network. It has 1 or 2 terabytes of storage, and then connects to all the other Space Monkeys. And if you, it's like a Dropbox, that uses a distributed network of hard drives that are attached to network, and I think it's genius. It's brilliant. It's breaking up the idea of centralized data centers and redistributing storage to the people. And it works. It's based on redundancy, so that if one hard drive fails, it's not a problem because files that you store on this virtual network is multiply broken up in small parts and then stored everywhere, and it's not expensive. And
okay. No, I never heard of it, but thank you so much.
Yeah.
I've noted it and will have pleasure in checking it out.
I mean, to pick up on that, I mean, the one thing that struck me that I always find troubling, I kind of want to go along with this thought on, you know, like we have to think through the political economy in terms of the dominance of finance, and there's you know, there's lots of arguments to that. But then if you get this term algorithmic capitalism, it really strikes me that, like, that doesn't hold at all, right? Because in all sorts of, because you're doing, on one hand, you're doing this really nice account of how these things work and how, you know, the protocols, the algorithms and stuff are all the parameters, they're all kind of involved in this production of, you know, supply chains and in the reproduction of capital. You know, and you show that very nicely. But to then go and say, okay, here's algorithmic capitalism and here's this hole, and, you know, every algorithm does something, you know, that means we can't get away from capital. That I just don't buy. And this is also where the fault lines, there's so many fault lines, I guess, that must become apparent, and where it's a question of maybe tracing something of how these technologies are produced and used and so on that requires, you know, still a kind of a lot more work in terms of linking up also how it's, you know, kind of employed, used, and how it's designed and so on, and how it can be used, taken apart, you know, stolen and reassembled and so on, I think. So I'm kind of, you know, I don't know if you can say something about...
Yeah, well, I guess this was the gesture I was trying to make by connecting, you know, the machine to, you know, the idea of a post-population. And I guess I gave a pretty negative spin on the post-population, because I suggested that there's a form of surplus value being generated through the rise of post-populations in the Shanzhai culture, for example, in the, you know, the metal extraction kind of economy, the waste economy, and so forth. So I guess I can only say I you're right. It's unresolved. I need to think through it, and I just find it intriguing.
But it reminded me of what we talked about with Christoph before, this automatic subject that these guys imagine, and like, okay, the human's out, and now it's just all these weird flows, and nobody knows who's doing it, and it seems like it's not very satisfying.
Do you think there's going to be, because right now Shanzhai, exclusively applies to end consumer products, to gadgets per se. But do you think there's also a chance that we will see Shanghai infrastructures?
Well, I think the idea of space monkeys, in a sense, is a Shanghai infrastructure. I could think of it in those terms. And you see Shanghai culture kind of being celebrated in ways that aren't limited in the cultural scene in Shanghai, for example, to the manufacturing of mobile phones, right? So Shanghai culture kind of becomes everything that, you know, it's kind of like neo-punk in a way, right? Because it reappropriates whatever, you know, manufactured products you care to name and re-engineers them in ways that, you know, aren't kind of expected by the designers of those products.
Can you help us with the dummies? What is Shanghai?
Shanghai is a...
like a copy culture.
Well, it's not a copy, it's a copy and improvement culture. Basically what they do is they have huge online forums where people sort of collectively vote on what kind of features they would like to see in a mobile phone maybe, and then they have sort of a grey production in big manufacturing companies in China where they suddenly they do fakes, but they're not really fakes, they're actually better, they're not mock-ups, you know?
Yeah.
It's a phone that has the same functionality that whatever your iPhone has, but it has like three or four other features, like a double SIM card slot or something like that. And they're actually quite amazing. I mean, they're sort of hybrid gadgets.
Yeah. So it's Shanzhai. So it
means
Shanzhai.
And you have the Galliaha in Brazil as well.
Right.
Was there any more questions, David? Maybe I was wondering if there are two other aspects which were kind of maybe peripheral to your interest, but maybe interesting. One thing is that I heard that in Switzerland they started to replace normal internet by internet access, or to produce internet without net connection.
Yeah.
So that you have. Several people with computers, and they produce their own net.
So these things.
One thing, and the other thing is that at least I know that there's an interesting connection between simulation of production line and simulation of urban space in Fraunhofer Institute in Magdeburg. They have a very powerful computer there, and they can simulate the whole production line for big car companies and others. So what about the role of these scientific institutions?
Yeah.
Well, very, very powerful and extremely new. Some of these machines only stand at one place. And I think that's also true for the history of that we heard yesterday, that you had like little villages or spots where some thing was experimentally produced. And it's a mixture of private or company and freak and let's say a bricolage culture. So what about the role of that?
They're fascinating examples, and I think particularly the second one, is something that would say more about kind of conditions in which we see these centres, these architectures. Being emerged and developed and demystified.
Yeah.
And the first example is sort of multiplied in all sorts of ways across Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
You hear this story quite a bit. Yeah.
Was that a hand? Last question.
Can you hint about the struggle between the grassroots give back all the control of machines, people and the companies, and research institutions and whatever. The one of the things is like the space monkey stuff with the torrent-based technology, known for 10 years ago or so. When you have these boxes, you need to have your own internet, so Fightlink or others try to get this one and so on and so forth. Because a lot of stuff going on this grassroots place, whatever, with the dream, more or less, in my opinion, idealistic dream of getting back the control.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the company is offering so easy use of their services that there's no need for thinking about grassroots anymore. So what is your opinion about this control battle between company control and grassroots control?
Well, I guess it's that basic sort of thought on how value and capital accumulation are replenished through precisely these kind of low-level operations. And then, you know, that seems to be decided upon which to devise the strategy of intervention. I mean, I'm all for this sort of, naive as it is, let's say, you know, utopian thought that I think defined, right? The 90s, certainly, in the account that we heard yesterday. And so, you know, what does that mean for analyzing the conditions of the present? Right, even if, you know, it's a way of undertaking analysis as well, right, of diagnosis. And I think, certainly in media theory, we don't sufficiently diagnose the conditions of the present. And so how might we go about that? I think, expropriation is inevitable, we could say, right? Exploitation, blah, blah, blah. But in a sense, so what, right? Like, let's make the master plan. I love that idea.
Martin Mantis argument would be in the Citadel argument that unless, you can do the decentralizing thing just to a scale, to a certain scale, and afterwards you need the big players because, or when you go beyond that scale, you become a big player, and then you are in this monopolistic structure. He formulated a bit like a Naturgesetz, so I don't know if I would like to subscribe that, but I think it's a point the question of I don't know, Machtpolitiken are also are related to the question of scale in a way.
Mm.
But it's just an aspect.
But Martin is like, of course, relating to scalable networks, and he's talking about the power hubs, but it's static in a sense. And I have to relate to Rodrigo's book, and he says, like, nodes can become strategic for a certain moment. You don't need to have this kind of hegemonic idea that they have to become a power hub and stay there. You can also, in an event, they become strategic for a certain moment,
okay.
And then disappear.
And then disappear. Okay.
Or multiply, or scale up. But it's not like this naturalistic idea that you have to become a power hub to become, you know, strategic for a certain moment.
No, it's deontologized in a sense.
It's event politics, no? Like also Brian is talking about.
Thanks, Dan.
This is the User Experience Gamburg Radio. Thanks for listening. Visit the UXLH-radio.blogspot.de for more live recordings.